This morning we want to finish off talking about education as an important part of the culture of ancient Rome and Greece. We mentioned that we talk about the word culture, definitionally, culture is simply all the elements that make us human. If you go to university and study humanities, which is a category of studies, that usually comprises the subject matter of culture. So the things that make us human, as God has created us, are language, religion, art, music, even history. These are sometimes considered cultural in the sense they are part of the making of man. But because God made us, we look to His Word as being the ultimate textbook for who we are and what we are. And that being the case, we've been talking about education for the last couple of lessons. We talked about elementary education, then what we might kind of call a middle school education. We finish off this morning, and for the sake of time, we only have 9 sessions left, including today, so I have a lot to cover. So we'll try to get through all that we can. The advanced, where we left off, is simply at age 18. At age 18, similar to our curricula today, a student entered for a year in an epheba, as it's called in the Greek language. An epheba was kind of like a finishing school for boys as they were about to enter adult life, kind of like going through undergraduate school or any kind of school where you're preparing for life, maybe a trade school or any kind of school where you're kind of finishing off the person to step out and become an adult. The stage in ancient Greece was more about societal life than academic, because graduation from this epheba actually propelled one either for a military or a political life of the city, both of which were considered very important in a person's education, especially and particularly for young men. It was also at this stage of life, this finishing school as it's called, that a person would then choose a profession, whether it be philosophy, law, medicine. A person could also go out to some kind of a trade of construction, certainly, but we're talking here about education and developing the mind for that for a profession. So then at that point, the young man would place himself under the direction of a philosopher, a lawyer, or a physician. When I read this, I was thinking maybe kind of like an apprenticeship of some kind, having a mentor to guide him along the way. We also want to make the note before, as we close this section out, that Judaic and Hellenistic education, that is the Jewish and the Greek education, followed the same format basically that we've gone through with all these stages of education. The difference would be, of course, and where the departure comes, is that the emphasis with a pagan education would be studying pagan authors. And so a young man at that time, at least in the Greco-Roman world, would study people like Homer, Sophocles, Euripides, orators of various kinds like Cicero, whom we'll mention later on. They would focus on that kind of study, whereas, of course, Jewish students would focus on the Torah, to which we've referred earlier. The Torah comprises the entire law of the Jews, along with any kind of learning that went with that. So that would be the departure right there. And one last note before we go on, a very important note is that, and I think I've already mentioned this before, but we want to reinforce it, the importance of education in our society, in ancient society, any society, is it pretty much determines the direction and the destiny of not only a society, but the individual. So whatever the perspective is in an education will help force the person to go that, well, I shouldn't say force, will lead a person to go that particular way. So while a Christian foundation begins with God, Proverbs 1:7, and continues with Him as a creator, Genesis 1:1, and sustainer, that is guiding through life, Colossians 1:17, a humanistic foundation, which we find in secular education, uses man as the starting point, such as, and maybe the most famous mantra that we use today goes back to Protagoras, who was one of the sophists and a Greek philosopher, but even before the time of the big three of Aristotle, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. He once made a statement that man is the measure of all things. In the fragments we have from the ancient Greek philosophers, few that they are, that was a very famous statement. Man is the measure of all things. And that was the idea that if you want to study creation and beginnings and purpose, you study man. So we see right there from that one statement. And today, in modern day, if you go back and look at secular humanism or any kind of humanistic credo or curriculum that's given, they may not use that particular statement, but the idea that man is the measure of all things. We know, of course, that God is the measure of all things. And so the secular education, the focus is on, it's about us. With Judaism and Christianity, it's about the fact that it's all about God, a major distinction. And when a person takes one of those two foundations for his or her education, that individual will then tend to go that way. So we need to bear that in mind. We now go on to another very important aspect of all society. It goes on today, slavery. We talk about slavery because there's so much misunderstanding about it. Slavery is not new. And we can say from the outset that from the beginning of time, if life goes on for another 100,000 or million years, there will always be slavery. Slavery occurs in the modern world. And before I make my comments about slavery in the ancient world, bear in mind it still goes on today. There are, according to some estimates, as many as 50 million slaves today around the world. Countries like North Korea, India, to my surprise, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and others, and even to some extent here in America, slavery goes on. When you hear stories about sex slavery, that's slavery. It's the same kind of thing, forcing people for some kind of sexual favors into slavery. When you have forced labor, when you hear about labor camps in China or other countries where people are forced to work, forced, any time you are forced to do something by someone who owns you or has power over you, that's a form of slavery. So it goes on. So slavery has not gone away. And the only reason we're going to study slavery is not to get into any kind of political discourse about it and argue the good or bad of slavery or whether we should have it or not. It's not that. We want to talk about it in terms of the New Testament, the whole purpose of our study. This is a cultural study of the New Testament, the period of time in which the gospel was born when Christ came. Look at it. We want to try to point out exactly what it was, what it wasn't, and also point out the biblical concept of slavery, what Bible has to say about it, and hopefully remove some misconceptions, because slavery is greatly misunderstood. The first point we want to bear in mind, and I just like to put these in kind of bullet points, we consider that as repugnant as slavery seems to be to the modern mind, it was a common practice in the ancient world. It goes on today, not as much as it did originally, but back when it went on, and even millennia before Christ, we're going back thousands of years even before Christ, slavery has always been two things: an expected part of a culture and an essential part of the fabric of society. And you might say, well, how could it be essential? The one thing we often forget is that today, many of the things that we do because of our utilities, we have gas, electricity, we have internal combustion engines to move us around. We have many technological developments in the last couple of hundred years that facilitate our lives. We can turn on lights and we can turn on a faucet for water. Back in the ancient world, they lacked these particular facilities and technology. As a result, then, what really provided it was human labor. And so it was expected in ancient societies that who would do these kinds of things to bring water, to produce any kind of energy that we have, it would be the sweat and tears of human labor, and that was slavery. So it was expected and essential. As we go on later on and talk about Paul, the Apostle Paul and slavery in the New Testament, I want you to bear that in mind and why Paul didn't speak out against it. Why didn't Paul, we're going to talk about why he didn't. In my research for this particular presentation, one of the books in my library is Paul, the biography of Paul, based on all the things we know about Paul from biblical and extra-biblical sources, a very good book by N.T. Wright, a scholar, New Testament scholar. He stated, and I choose these quotes only because they really summarize the points I want to make so well. He said in his investigation of the ancient world that slavery in the ancient world did everything that is done in our world by oil and gas, electricity, all the things that we have today, we accomplished by the technology that we have. Denouncing slavery back in this time, we'll talk about that with Paul, denouncing it and saying we ought to get rid of it right now would have been like denouncing electricity or the internal combustion engine. Imagine today somebody get up and say, we want to get rid of electricity, we want to get rid of our waterworks, we want to get rid of all of that. Nobody would say that. It would bring our civilization pretty much to a standstill. And so back at this time, because slavery provided so much of that work and effort and technology of that time, it was simply a part that was accepted. And we would like to have heard Paul come out, or others, maybe other apostles, and condemn slavery. And sometimes people wonder, why didn't they condemn it? Because again, make a little footnote here, slavery is repugnant. I mean, the very idea that a person owns another and forces him or her to do that person's bidding, especially under harsh conditions, and on top of that has the power of life or death, which many slave masters had over their servants, that seems so morally, socially, culturally repugnant to us. But the problem is, and we want to point out to one that I want to make, sometimes we have this misconception that because something is recorded in the Bible, that God approves of it. Well, God approves of slavery because it's talked about in the Bible. Well, that'd be like saying that God approves of sin because sin's in the Bible. Just because something's recorded or written about historically, Old or New Testament, doesn't mean God approves of it. It's simply a part of the fabric of society. And so to expect the Bible to come out and condemn slavery isn't necessarily an expectation that we should have, because it was a part of society then. It didn't mean God approved of it. God would never approve of somebody taking another human being and beating or whipping or even having the power of life or death. That wasn't the idea. It was a part of society, and we're looking at it now only to appreciate what it was like in the ancient world, to have a better understanding of the culture of the New Testament into which the gospel was born. So bear that in mind. We also want to mention, I'll give you a little preview as we get to the end of this, that we'll see later on that Christianity was not only the major, by some say the only real force that actually helped to get rid of abolish slavery. Slavery hasn't been abolished around the world. We still have it, I mentioned that. But it had a great deal to do with the fact of improving conditions for slaves, if not getting rid of it. So we'll get to that later on. A second point I want to make, again, staying in the realm of ancient history now, as harsh as slavery was in the Roman Empire, it was not always that way in the Old Testament world. With the slavery we talk about with whips and chains and beatings and the misery, it usually comes more out of the pagan society. If you go back and look at passages like Deuteronomy, I've noted a couple of them, 16, 10 and 11, 23, 15, 16, Exodus 20, 10, you'll find references to manservants, which means slaves. And it talks about the fact that in the Old Testament, even slaves were treated with a certain amount of humanity and respect, and they had certain rights. So even in the Old Testament, under Judaism, the slave was not the really down. He was still an unfortunate person in some respects, but he was given more the class of somebody working for somebody than somebody being enslaved. So bear that in mind, because the slavery we will talk about as being so harsh and tyrannical was more the pagan concept of slavery. And you might say, what's the distinction? Throughout the Bible, of course, God puts a high premium in human life, because God created life. Life is sacrosanct to God because he made us in his image. There's a high regard for life. When you get into societies, ancient or modern, where they don't have that same regard for human life or the value of it, is where you're more likely to see slavery. Because in evolutionary thinking, if you see a person as an animal, or a person as simply a being with no particular soul or spirit, then he might be considered fair game for slavery. So again, we go back to education. If you're educated that life really has no more meaning than a biological animal, then of course you're going to tend to treat maybe a human just like a cow. And in some cases, animals were treated better in ancient Rome, than people were. That's education. Whereas if your education is to regard life as the gift of God in his image, you're going to have a different orientation. So that's where education comes in. So we want to bear that in mind. We also want to point out historically that by the time of Jesus Christ, when he came along, slavery among the Jews, as far as we know historically, had all but disappeared among the Jews. It continued in the ancient world, and we're going to talk more about that. It continued in the pagan world of Rome. A third point to make as we talk about slavery is to give some facts historically about slavery, because you want to know exactly what you're talking about. Slavery, of course, is enforced labor. That is, you might say, well, I'm a slave at my job. No, you can quit your job if you want. You can quit that, okay? And if you play for a professional sports team, last couple of years, we read incidents of certain NFL players saying, it's a slave trade here. No, you can quit the football team. You can leave. You know, you forget about that sometimes. It's when you have no choice. When somebody holds a gun to your head or a sword to your throat and says, you will do this, that's slavery. And the slaves of the ancient world had that condition. They couldn't just walk off without the threat of you know, being beaten or, you know, killed. So bear that in mind when we talk about slavery. It was enforced. It was mandatory. A person had no way out. There's some cases a person could eventually buy his freedom or earn it in some way, but generally it was at the behest of the owner, who had full control over his slave at that time. So some facts about slavery based on the history that we know from the records that are left to us. As Rome grew, I have read that at Rome's height, it was about maybe 120 million people at its golden period. And as many as 60 million of those people were slaves, which is, that sounds, you know, incredible. About half the people were slaves within the empire, about half the population. And B, a second point is, as we're going to talk about as we get to Onesimus later on, many Christians were a part of that life as well. Onesimus being one of them, the book of Philemon, that we'll get to as we go along. There were some individual, some affluent Romans, very wealthy Romans, who owned up, we know, had as many 20,000 slaves. So a person with a vast acreage of farms or land or ranches would require a lot of labor. So he could have 20,000 slaves. And many slaveholders, as I've already, to which I made reference earlier, were known to be quite brutal, very brutal. And they held the power of life or death within legal authority. So many times Rome would simply say to the owners, you can do what you want with your slaves. If they disobey you to the extent that they deserve capital punishment, then you can destroy them. So the owners really had that. So that would cause a slave to be in constant trepidation before his owner, knowing that if I misbehave or do the wrong thing, you know, like walking on eggshells, I could be killed, let alone, you know, I mean, punished some one way or another. A note of irony as we go along in the study here is that what's ironic about slaves is that many of the slaves were actually more highly educated than their owners. Some of them were doctors, lawyers, philosophers. Some even served as pedagogues. We talk about the pedagogos of Galatians 3, 25, 26, and 7, that many of the people who actually taught the owners children as they went along or guided them along the way were also slaves. We need to make a footnote. I don't have it in here, but the source of slaves. Slaves were either criminals, people taken from foreign lands, captive, you know, in battles, they would bring slaves back, or people who from a young age were brought up as slaves. We're going to see later on that many young women, because women were not considered that important in the pagan culture, that many of them actually went out because they weren't really regarded with any value by their parents. They would go out and engage in prostitution or life on the street or becoming slaves. So those were some of the sources of slavery, where the slaves came from. But among those that were brought back from foreign battle, when they went off into a battle of a foreign country and brought back individuals and captured those people, many of them were these doctors, lawyers, and philosophers, and even pedagogues or mentors who really were in a greater educational capacity than their owners, but they could do nothing with it because they were slaves. So the idea these slaves were just simply uneducated, uncouth barbarians, no, not at all. Many of them were much higher than their owners as far as their morality, their education, their status, but because the master had power over them, they were subjugated to that. And so we need to bear that in mind. Also, adding to the horror of slaves, and we've already made reference to this, owners could, upon a whim, just a whim, you know, no particular reason, have a servant executed with a tacit approval of Rome. And again, the idea of walking on eggshells. If you've ever, and I have in my life, lived around people in your family or friends, you didn't know what they were going to do. They would tend to be ballistic, you know, you could never predict them. I've lived under people like that, with people where, you know, I was walking on eggshells, again, so to speak, because I didn't know what I might do that would set them off. And so some of the slave masters were also given this authority that you don't have to have a really good, legitimate reason to kill your slave. If you know, if that slave doesn't prepare your food the way you want, and you wanted to kill him, they had the right to do that. That might be a radical example, but the point is, it was the whim. So, in other words, the slave owner never had to go through a legislative process. He never had to go to a court and say, now, may I, you know, execute this slave or punish him? They would say, he's your slave, you own him, do what you want. So imagine, so we talk about the torment. We often distinguish punishment and torment. Punishment is something that's done from the outside. Torment arises on the inside. So when you go through punishment because somebody has whipped you or hurt you in some way, or you know, lambasted you verbally, that comes from without. But then once you are punished that way, or you're living in a situation where you're constantly afraid, that produces what's called a torment or an anxiety of the mind, which in some ways is even worse. We're told that hell will be punishment and torment, that people will be punished from without and within for what they have done, a horrible situation to be. And these slaves, of course, were living under that condition. Historically, we also notice that during his reign, Augustus Caesar, from 27 BC to 14 AD, who was the first official emperor of Rome, that we know from records, he executed as many as 30,000 slaves for various reasons, for whatever reasons. So his own slaves, he would simply very, you know, I guess, just randomly, just, I say randomly, for whatever reason, would execute people based on his whim. Another humiliating factor that and this adds to the torment, the humiliation. You know, the physical pain of being a slave is enough. Being whipped, being put on the rack, all the things, I mean, that's certainly bad enough. And being left alive, not killed, you know, you might wish you were dead, is, of course, the psychological impact of humiliation, of making slaves feel like they were either below human, which they were considered subhuman, maybe even below the level of an animal, is that one particular practice we know from notes from historians, is that some owners, if they had a slave who was a thief, and I guess they had other designations, would often brand them on the face, like a tattoo, a permanent tattoo. I don't know if it was the forehead, but somewhere on the face they would actually put a print there, and they would put CF, of course, which stood for Latin cave furum, which means beware the thief. So the idea that they would make that slave then go around wearing that, as if the enslavement were not bad enough to humiliate the person by letting everybody know this person's a slave. When I read this, I was thinking of Hester Prynne immediately in The Scarlet Letter, who had to wear the A because of her adultery. So it was not just simply the physical punishment or the psychological trauma, but the social stigma of going, you know, this man's a thief, and walking around with that. So all this was all done. There is one positive note about slavery. The comments we're making so far are just general comments about slavery around the world, but slavery was not monolithic. Depending on the country in which the slavery occurred, that it varied among nations. We've already mentioned that in ancient Israel, by the time of Christ, slavery had almost disappeared. So with Israel, it kind of passed along the way because of the influence of God and God's word, of course, influenced there. But for example, in Egypt, slaves were treated with care and protection. So we go back and look at ancient societies. You take a country like Egypt, we know from records left down historically that in Egypt, they actually had protection and rights for some of their slaves. And we also know that generally speaking, historically, that after the time of Augustus, I mentioned, you know, killing 30,000 slaves, that from after his time, treatment of slaves improved. It was still bad. It was still harsh under the other emperors. I'm not saying it wasn't, but it got better and better. Because I think there was a growing awareness among human beings that we are people, that we're not animals, and so they were given rights. There could have been other political reasons for doing it, but we certainly could bear that in mind. Now, giving that background to slavery of the ancient world, some general comments, we want to bring it down to the Bible itself, Paul. Paul and slavery. And by Paul, we could say all the apostles, all the biblical writers. We're going to center on Paul. Sometimes you make it more specific, it's easier to focus on what we're talking about. Some points to bear in mind. Why didn't Paul come out and say, slavery is evil, it's bad, you shouldn't own other humans, you shouldn't treat them the way you do? He could have done that. Why didn't he do that? He certainly could. Well, Paul wouldn't have approved of slavery. We can know that for certain. He wouldn't have approved of one person beating somebody and killing for some way. We can know that. But we have to bear in mind why Paul would not have spoken out. To bear this in mind, there are two things that Paul was not. He was not a political activist. Now, if you pay attention to political news nowadays, which I do, political activism is people getting out there militantly, you know, protesting and marching, and they're advocating for their cause. They want some action to be taken for their cause. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong for advocating for a cause you believe in, as long as you aren't violent or deadly, you know, then we have that right in America. But Paul wasn't a political activist. His concern was not going out there and marching and holding up signs, you know, ban slavery. That wasn't his purpose. That wasn't his purview. He wasn't naive. He was aware of slavery. He knew that. And nor was he a social reformer. He wasn't out for social justice. I get so tired of hearing that. He wasn't out for social justice, whatever that is. He wasn't for that. He was out to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now you might say, well, does that mean he didn't care about societal problems? Not at all. I'm sure Moses, Abraham, all the way down to Paul, they were aware of the injustices in society. God was aware of them, but that was not his focus or his purpose. And so while Paul didn't condone slavery, he understood it was a part of their society. It was a part of the fabric of their lives. And it actually did not hinder service to Christ. And I'll mention this in a moment. So his concern there was to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ, not to bring any undue attention to himself. Paul had enough problems from Rome. He had enough difficulty preaching the gospel as it was. But to come out and advocate against something that was a part of society would have brought more censure and more recognition to him, you know, negative attention. He did not want that. Paul was not concerned about getting rid of slavery as much as learning exactly what it is and how to live with it as a servant of Jesus Christ. In 1 Corinthians 7, 20 and 21, he actually makes a reference to slavery there. And the apostle writes, a very important note there, he kind of gives us insight to what he thought about slavery. He writes basically that in whatever social state you are, including slavery. Slavery is a social condition. It's a condition of you as a person in your society. That even in whatever state you are, slavery, one found himself not to worry about it. And you might say, well, boy, that's easy for Paul to say because I'm a slave and being beaten every day. Now, Paul sympathized with that. But he was making the point, I'm not here as an apostle to try to change Roman society. One, because I can't do it. And secondly, it's not what I'm here to do at all. So he was aware of that. And he says in those verses, if you read very carefully, that if you are a slave, learn to live with that. We'll talk more about that in a minute. He goes on to say, though, and I've forgotten the part of the verse where he mentions it, that if you can free yourself, then do so. So he's saying that if you have the opportunity to buy your freedom or to earn your freedom, or really, he doesn't say run away illegally. As Paul was teaching in Philemon, that you know, if you belong to a master, then you need to recognize your responsibility as a servant to a master, whether you like it or not. So he's not saying to run away illegally. He's simply saying if you have the chance to become free, then do it, you know, take it. But if not, don't worry. And he's not saying don't worry because, you know, like, well, it's easy for you to say, Paul, because you're not being beaten every day and humiliated. He's not disallowing any of that or ignoring that. He's simply saying that your number one purpose, as far as I'm concerned, is to serve Jesus Christ, even as a slave, as difficult as that might be. So just continue serving. And as I said, in verse 21, he says that if you can be free of that, then fine, you can certainly do that. I'm kind of getting ahead here, but in Philemon, the book of Philemon, which we studied a couple of years ago in this class, a class that I taught, very good book. You remember that Philemon, of course, is the master, Onesimus is the slave who's run away. And in that letter, Paul never once says, Onesimus, take off, get out of here, I'll cover for you. He doesn't say that. He says, Onesimus, you must go back to Philemon because he's your rightful owner. And if you do go back, as I hope that he will, he might well free you. And if he does, then you are a free man. If not, you still owe yourself to Philemon. And Paul was also a good friend of Philemon. So he was also speaking to Philemon and saying, Philemon, I would like you to take him back. So Paul was being very diplomatic. He was being very gracious and godly in trying to reconcile these parties to get them back together. So again, Paul was not saying, Onesimus, here, get out of here, I'll let you run away. No, that would be illegal, against the laws, and we're told to obey the laws of the land. And slavery was legalized under Rome. So it was a legal system, whether you liked it or not. So Paul wasn't, again, a social reformer. He wasn't a political activist. He was an apostle of Jesus Christ, saying our number one priority is to serve God, no matter what our condition might be. And I'll say more about that later on. My second point is, Well, I've already said this. Paul is not about political revolution. He's about spiritual reformation, which came from one of my sources. I love that phrase. He didn't want to revolt politically. He wanted to reform spiritually, which the gospel of Jesus Christ does. Now, any such agitation that Paul might have caused against the Roman Empire would have put him as an apostle under the microscope, even more so by the Roman Empire. It would have put him into very dangerous territory. If Paul had come out and said, marching around, ban slavery, slavery's no good, it would have made even things more difficult for him. And he realized that, we're sure. So he thought, I'm going to be very diplomatic and go on and encourage my people, that is Christians, to keep serving Jesus Christ and deal with slavery the best you can. Again, if you can get your freedom, if you can do that, fine, but let's go on with it. And so Paul didn't want to bring about more grief from Rome because he had enough as it was. And if he had done that, think about this too. This gets back to providence, God guiding Paul along the way. If Paul had not been able to carry out his mission of preaching the gospel to the Gentile world, then of course that would have defeated his purpose for being here as an apostle. So the idea that, no doubt in my mind, that God providentially would have guided him in such a way that he can continue to do his work with as little pressure as possible. And opposing slavery would have just intensified, it would have exacerbated that pressure against him. He didn't want that. A third point we want to make also about being kind of negative, so far more positive. By New Testament times, conditions of slavery were improving. Things were starting to turn around. By the grace of God, by the providence of God, by the fact that human hearts were changing. We'll say more about that later on. When the heart changes, that's what's going to really change people's mind about slavery. So reformation of the heart is much more powerful than revolution against the political system. And I've already mentioned that Paul wanted Onesimus, who was a slave, to return to Philemon, the master. If you go back and read that short letter. He saw these two people now, the master and the slave, not as master and slave, but as brothers in Christ. If you read that letter very carefully, Paul's pointing out to Onesimus and to Philemon too, because he was in conversation with both of them. He was pointing out that you are brothers in Jesus Christ. And he was saying to Philemon in that letter that Philemon, and they were friends as well. Paul and Philemon, we know, were friends and could be able to speak to each other like a brother to brother. Biologically or spiritually. And Paul was saying to Philemon that when he comes back to you, treat him as a brother, because Philemon's a Christian, and Onesimus has become a brother in Jesus Christ as well. And for Paul, that trumps everything else. Whether you are a slave and a master, an employer, an employee, it doesn't matter what your relationship might be, the most important thing is you are Christians. The late John MacArthur, he's a denominational preacher, but he was a great preacher, actually. He states this in his commentary very well. He says, the New Testament nowhere directly attacks slavery. Had it done so, the resulting slave insurrection that would have occurred, the rebellion, would have been brutally suppressed. They would have been destroyed if they had tried to do that. And the message of gospel would have been hopelessly confused with that of social reform. So what would have happened if Paul had advocated for the abolition of slavery? He would have been seen as a social reformer or a political activist, and no one would have thought, we don't need that, and you got rid of him. Paul didn't want that. He wanted to be able to go on and proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ, which the Pax Romana had afforded him to do, and therefore to do that, he didn't want to bring about that kind of calamity upon himself. So then, as I've already mentioned, as John MacArthur mentions, instead of doing that, Paul did the godly thing, the right thing. He undermined the evils of slavery by changing the hearts of slaves and masters. And the most poignant case we see is the book of Philemon, with exactly what happened. And I want to make a note also that I think I'm going to mention this later. I'm going to say it now. In the book of Philemon, people often wonder, when Onesimus went back to Philemon, when he went back, how was their relationship? Well, we assume that because Philemon was a godly man and Paul had faith in him, that Philemon took him back as a slave and maybe even freed him. Because years later in Ephesus, and I've forgotten the exact year, it's in my notes here, we'll probably see it later on, then we find out there was an elder in the church at Ephesus whose name was Onesimus. Now, whether it was the same one or not, we don't know. But many scholars infer from historical study that could have been the very same Onesimus who was an elder in the church, which we then infer from that he had been freed and not only become a free man, but even became an elder. So we don't know that for certain, but it's something to think about as well. Fourth point, the abolition of slavery as we move along here. And I've already said this in the beginning. As long as men desire to own human beings, and that will always go on, there are vicious, mean people who want to own others, to make them sweat and toil and do their labor, to have power over them. It's an ego trip for man, the arrogance of that. I have full power over you. That's going to go on until the end of time. We know that. If the world goes on for 100,000 years, we'll have slavery in the future. However, the great news, and I believe this was Paul's concern, is that Christianity has had as much impact, if not the most impact, in abolishing slavery as any other institution or any other movement in history. And again, when the heart of man begins to change, and I go back and cite Philemon and Onesimus, when you change that heart of a man, then of course that changes his whole orientation, it changes his focus, it gives him a whole list of priorities he didn't have before. And one biblical scholar in my notes actually made the observation that Christianity abolished slavery. Now you might say abolish, it's still around. What he means there is that Christianity, as far as it was concerned, wanted to abolish slavery and got rid of it as far as it was concerned, though it still goes on in our world. It abolished slavery not by denouncing it, as we wonder why Paul didn't do that, but by teaching the doctrine of human brotherhood. And again, I cite again and again, the book of Philemon is a good example of that. That when you actually change the hearts of men to show that we are brothers in Christ, we are brothers as creatures of God, then how are you going to own your brother? How are you going to beat your brother? I mean, there are brothers who do things, bad things to brothers. I realize that. But when you start to see now that Onesimus, as Philemon would think, who is my servant now, is my brother in Christ, it's going to make you see him differently. And even I thought about this also. Even if Philemon had continued to own Onesimus, even if he had, I have no doubt it would have changed their relation. It would have improved it. That if there had been any beating, I mean, how can you beat or whip or put to death your brother in Christ? You don't do that because your heart's been changed. So that's a very important note. And one final note, and I've already talked about this some, so I want to just reinforce it. The short letter of Philemon, that one little letter in the Bible, it's 23 verses, I've forgotten, very short, but a very powerful book, has been powerful in its effect on showing how people in Christ constitute a family in the deepest sense. If I can say this with great pride that I'm just about the only person in my family. My parents, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins are gone. I'm pretty much the run of the family that's left over. But I can safely say that in my life as a Christian, in my adult life, that I have a stronger tie to my brothers and sisters in Christ than my own family. Now, some say that's a hard thing to say. Well, it's true, though. I didn't grow up with most of my family. I was living far away. I didn't grow up with them at all. But even my parents, kind of strange relationship. But I mean, the fact is, I feel stronger because I have a spiritual connection. Our biological connections are important. I'm not denying those or disparaging those, but it's a spiritual bond. The spiritual bond goes with us through eternity. The bond biologically ends at the end of life. So think about that consideration right there. But one particular the note I wanted to make was that in manners and customs of the Bible, which talks about the very culture of the New Testament, one author has said that Paul's letter to Philemon has, no doubt, done more to overcome slavery than any other document ever written. I'll make a note here about literature also. If you ever read Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe, that was written during the Civil War period, and that book had a great deal to do with the abolition of slavery, because it talks about the horrible slave conditions in the world. And even Harriet Beecher, it was either Harriet Beecher Stowe herself or one of the reviewers of her work, I don't know which it was, who actually said she considered her book a book of God. And what she meant was, the reason she took such a strong stand against slavery in Uncle Tom's Cabin was because of her influence of the Bible in her life. So sometimes literature, the Bible itself, Philemon, the book of the Bible, or a novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin, can have a profound effect on reaching people's hearts and changing them. So bear that in mind. And again, I'll make my last note about slavery before we go on. I think we're going to continue. Hang on, let me go back here. Overall, our focus as human beings, as Christians, should be serving Christ. And that's what Paul talks about. No matter our circumstances, no matter what our circumstances are, even slavery. Slavery is a circumstance in life. Paul speaks about this in Philippians 4, 11 through 13. He doesn't specifically mention slavery, but he doesn't have to, because he implies in those verses, he says quite clearly, that and Paul had been through all kinds of horrific conditions. He had been in slave-like conditions in his life, his beatings and floggings, and to the point of near point of death. He says in those verses, and I'm paraphrasing, that I've gone through all kinds of circumstances in my life. I've been up and I've been down. I've been rich. I've been poor. I've been everything. He had some kind of a physical handicap. We don't know what it was. He prayed for God to take away. Paul had gone through the ringer in his service to Christ. But he says, I've also learned. And the key word there is I've learned. We learn our conditions about how we live. So it wasn't just automatic. I have learned and I have gained from all those negative experiences and even the positive ones that no matter what my social standing, no matter what my state in the world, I'm content with whatever I have because I serve Jesus Christ. He goes on to mention in verse 13 that we are servants of Christ, and that stands above and beyond all else. So we can work to improve society. I'm not saying we shouldn't advocate against slavery and, you know, protest it. That's fine to do all of that. You know, by voting for laws or reforms against slavery, that's fine to do all of that. However, our greatest, and I think this is what Paul would say if he were here today, our greatest contribution in the world against slavery or any other kind of injustice in the world is to have a pure heart serving God and others. If we have a pure heart serving God and others, and I believe we all do because that's why we're here this morning, that is the greatest weapon against slavery or injustices that can possibly be. And just think about how that alone would improve our world. It would improve our moral world, our spiritual world. It would improve our social world if we all had hearts that had been turned to God that way. And, I'm getting to the next topic now. So I'm going to do something really strange. Any comments? Anybody want to say anything? No? Okay. I don't want to start now because I'm going to start talking. I don't have my heading up there. Where's my heading? It's gone. Anyhow, talking about now about domestic life, the family. We've now talked about education and its importance. We've talked about slavery and its significance. We will now go and start talking about domestic life, the family. What was family life like at this time? Thank you very much for your attention this morning.